From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The director of a LaSalle State Veterans Home has been fired. The director of the nursing facility has also been placed on administrative leave pending the outcome of the ongoing investigation on just how this outbreak has been handled.
Here in Illinois, we will leave no stone unturned in our efforts to safeguard our most vulnerable, especially those who lived to serve.
There was protocol, and the ball was dropped in many places, and we need those answers so we can move forward in an effective way to ensure that we save lives. And the lack of urgency from this administration should be concerning to every Illinoisan.
That was Republican Representative David Welter of Morris. Before that, Governor J.B. Pritzker. The governor this week announced the administrator of the LaSalle Veterans Home was let go after an outbreak that, as of Friday morning, has taken the lives of 33 people and sickened many more. The National Guard is being brought into that and other veterans' homes to assist with testing. Also behind the scenes, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan is making his push to keep his powerful position as a scandal swirls around him. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel is with us. She's NPR Illinois' government and politics reporter. And also joining us today, we have Jerry Nowicki, State House Bureau Chief for Capital News Illinois. And Jerry, it's good to have you on once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's get up to speed on the latest developments regarding the LaSalle Veterans Home. We have watched these numbers rise both in cases and in deaths. This outbreak started back in early November. And Hannah, I know there's an investigation that's underway about what led to this outbreak and how it's all been handled, but why did the governor move now to let the administrator there go and place the director of nursing on leave while this investigation is still pending?
You know, it's unclear because, the outbreak started, it was first reported by the Homes Administrator on November 1st, the first four infections. And the outbreak was really, really bad the first 3 weeks of November, in terms of spread. And it's definitely slowed down a lot since then. And now we have, these 33 deaths of the residents. And, there's still a lot of folks who are sick and testing positive, but the spread has slowed. So it's interesting and puzzling to folks, especially, the governor's Republican detractors who represent the LaSalle homes and home in their districts, is, if the Illinois Department of Public Health and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs had site visits while the outbreak was still, kind of at its peak in mid-November, then why did it take, 3 more weeks until there was a decision made on personnel? And so I asked the governor at his daily press briefing this week, or one of them, was your decision based on new information, or was it based on the information that you already had 2 to 3 weeks ago? And, if that's the case, then why did it take you so long? And he, didn't have an answer. But at this point, as the deaths keep mounting, and as there's a lot of, public pressure on him about, how it was handled, I think that he felt like he had to do something. And this was that something. And it was, firing the administrator of that home and placing the director of nursing on administrative leave. And of course, we have this independent investigation that is ongoing, but it could be several months until we know the results of that. So I think in the interim, he was feeling the pressure that he had to do something.
Yeah, Charlie, would you agree with that the governor, and I think even on our show, we have discussed that the governor needed to take some type of action to show he was addressing this problem. Is that what this was all about?
Well, I think, part of it is that he's got to do something because the situation is very dire. We've been focused on the veterans home in LaSalle, but there are 3 other veterans homes as well. And if I'm not mistaken, there have been outbreaks in Manteno, which is in Kankakee County, which is a county that's had a lot of bad experience with COVID. And also the Quincy Veterans Home in Adams County, where we had the unfortunate Legionnaires fatalities that occurred under Bruce Rauner's watch. Now, apparently, the home in Anna, way down in deep southern Illinois in Union County, hasn't had the same kind of problems as the other two, and none of the three have had the problems that we've had at LaSalle. And so there's this inspector general's reviewing what's going on, plus, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there are three separate legislative committees that are holding hearings to try and figure out what occurred. Why did it take so long for there to be some action taken? So on this one, I think the governor is reacting when ideally he should have been informed immediately what was going on, and he should have taken immediate steps to remedy it. Brought in the not necessarily the National Guard, but brought in the federal veterans people to take a look. The thing that stuck out, and we talked about this before, was the fact that they didn't have real hand sanitizer. They had some kind of, I don't know, perfumey thing to make your hands smell nice, as opposed to something that had the alcohol that would actually kill the virus. So yeah, this is one where I think the governor dropped the ball.
Yeah, Jerry, would you agree with that? This is something that this is an issue that the governor has to take responsibility for as well.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why he would get rid of the administrator. As Charlie mentioned, there was the Legionnaires outbreak at Quincy that the governor was very vocal about as a candidate, and to have that sort of pushing action to, I mean, politically, on top of the horrific human toll that it has taken, the outbreak at the home. Hannah said it too, you had to do something. And I don't know that there was, once you're in the middle of that outbreak, there's not much you're going to be able to do. You could slow it a little bit, but it's going to have to run its course just with the way this virus operates. So that it got to that point, maybe the hand sanitizer was a part of it, but the fact that it got to that point was very troublesome, and I don't know what else you could do at this point other than relieve the administrator who, you know, watched as it got to that point.
And it's always easy to second guess, but it occurs to me, I wonder if the governor may have thought to himself, gosh, we have this outbreak and it's affecting nursing homes, and we see these horrible statistics from these privately run or nonprofit nursing homes all across the state. Hey, we run four nursing homes for veterans. What's going on there? Maybe I should have somebody check on that and let me know. And this is something that I would suspect the governor is thinking to himself, man, I wish I would have done that early on.
Well, and that's a good point. And Hannah, let me ask you, because I know you've been following this a lot, but the fact that we did see these nursing home outbreaks really early on, but we did not hear a lot about veterans' homes, so maybe there was some thought that things were under control in those locations.
Right. I went back to all of the data that the homes have provided since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, after the disaster, the Legionnaires outbreak that killed, eventually 13 people at the Quincy Veterans Home, during the Rauner administration, the law was changed. And so any sickness has to be reported in these veterans' homes within 24 hours. So I went back, and really things had been pretty under control throughout most of this year. There had been a smaller outbreak at Manteno in, I think it was May, and that ultimately ended up killing two residents there. And there was a couple other, like, in LaSalle, I want to say that there had been a few very isolated staff members falling ill with COVID, but things had been under control. And way very early in the pandemic, Department of Veterans Affairs Director Linda Chapalovia, who she had served a decade or so in the House as a Democrat, she said things are under control. We are very well prepared for COVID in our homes. Well, this virus is pernicious. It can get in. It looks for hosts, and it is, you know, especially glad to prey on people who are very sick and elderly. Like I said last week on the show, yes, of course, like, this virus is going to get in anywhere it can. But the fact that it spread to, again, 90% of the residents in the LaSalle home and killed more than a quarter of them, when there have been nursing home outbreaks that are bad, but this is just particularly bad. Something went seriously wrong with protocol here.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News, Illinois. Well, Jerry, the scandal involving Commonwealth Edison, of course, we've been talking about that for a long time as well. It's threatened to end the long reign of House Speaker Michael Madigan, but the speaker did appear at a virtual event over the weekend, last weekend, involving the House Black Caucus. From what has been reported, Madigan making every attempt to hang on to his job. He is not going to go away without a fight.
Yeah, I think there's power in the House Black Caucus, and the speaker has allied himself with them in recent years, certainly. And they gave their support to the speaker, reportedly. Notably, there was one exception, Representative Maurice West from the Rockford area. He had said previously he would not vote for the speaker, and he said it again after that meeting. I won't even begin to make a prediction as to whether that's going to be enough to allow the speaker to maintain the gavel. But the question is whether it's enough to prevent one of his opponents from reaching the 60 vote threshold needed to become speaker. So if that's the case, they'd be sort of at loggerheads, and you never know what can result from that type of situation in the behind closed doors discussion as to who is going to lead the House in the coming legislative session.
Well, Charlie, the pendulum has sort of swung here again, because, you know, go back a month or so ago, there was many people that were just about to write Madigan off and say that we even discussed he might step down in any day at that point. And now, you know, here we are heading into the end of the year. The new legislative session will get underway in January. And there seems to be some momentum out there that maybe Madigan can hang on here. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, there's some momentum, and the fact that the Black Caucus, with the exception of Representative West, supported him, they pointed out that he has been supportive of their issues in the past. They have a pretty ambitious agenda dealing with inequity in education, healthcare, job opportunities that they want to get addressed in the coming session, and they think that he would be better poised than anyone else to be able to help him with it. But I still believe what I said from the get-go, that the people who have come out and publicly said we will not vote for him for speaker, I don't think any of them can change their mind and say, oh, well, guess what, I just figured out XYZ, so therefore I'm going to be for the speaker. And so I think that still leaves him short. And I suspect behind the scenes, there are a lot of discussions going on about, well, when the inevitable occurs and we organize in January and there are not 60 votes for Mike Madigan, then where do we go? None of us are going to give votes to Jim Durkin or the Republicans, because we look at the Republican record, particularly at the national level, and it's just abominable compared to our principles and our interests. So we have to choose one from among ourselves. Who will that be? And again, going back to ancient history, in 1975, the person who ultimately became speaker on the 93rd ballot was someone who, on the day the House organized itself in January of 75, was not a name that anyone would have thought of would emerge as the speaker at the end of these 93 ballots.
Hannah, do you agree with Charlie on that, that, you know, that these people cannot make this switch to go back after saying, I mean, we see politicians do that all the time. They say they're going to vote for something. They don't vote for it. Or they're going to oppose something, and then they wind up supporting it. Why is this one different?
Well, you know, Madigan has become such an overarching thing. I mean, you could call it a dark cloud. You could it colors everything. He colors everything. And he's not just a policy. He is, you know, he's larger than life. And honestly, I think that some of the caricatures that have been made out of him aren't necessarily true. Like, you know, the fact that he has total control, like, no, he doesn't have total control, but what he's good at and what he's always been good at is listening to his members. Although I guess not necessarily in this respect, but I just, you know, like we saw after Election Day, Democrats, you know, including Dick Durbin, moved pretty quickly to say that, you know, it was the speaker and his leadership that, you know, kind of cost a lot of Illinois Democrats their elections. And, you know, certainly we saw the governor's fare tax tied to, you know, Madigan and Democrats in Springfield and their decades of fiscal mismanagement, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, everything, he is just such a liability to the party. And yeah, I just don't think that you could be one of those 19 and have come out and like risked a lot in saying like, I can't vote for the speaker and then turn around and vote for him. It would just be the kiss of death to their political careers.
Yeah, Jerry, the Madigan may be a detriment to the party in some ways, but he's also, you know, maybe one of the few people who can pull different groups together, like the Black Caucus. And that's something that in what appears to be a very difficult time for state government, including when it comes to the state budget and maybe some very difficult decisions to be made here, that could be very valuable for Democrats. And so to throw him completely aside and say, oh, you know, some, you know, people voted against certain issues because of Madigan, that type of thing, that doesn't tell the whole story, does it?
Right. So with the 19 members, I wonder if there's a way to for them to sort of have their cake and eat it too, and that they say, you know, we've voted to give Madigan one more term and we've gotten his concession or whatever, that he will step down at the end of this 2 years. That could be the only way where I could see maybe some movement on that needle. But, you know, you wonder too if there's enough of an uprising to sort of unseat him, what behind the scenes levers he'll still be able to pull to kill anything from the members that he believes have cost him his leadership role. So can he maneuver to sort of slow the processes down if he is stripped of power? Who knows what kind of support he'll still gather. But, you know, you're going to need his, I don't know, it just seems like you're going to need the speaker's elbow grease to get some of the things done, especially in a difficult time like this.
And before we move on, Charlie, I'll let you have the kind of the last word on this. But I guess the other thing when it comes to Madigan is it's all dependent on this federal investigation, which we don't know where that stands. We don't know if more is going to happen with this or not, an indictment of Madigan. You know, who knows? That could happen. If something like that occurs, game is probably over. But if nothing occurs, he's still got a shot, right?
Well, yeah, as things stand now, he's not given any indication that he's going to step down. As I've said earlier in this show and in previous shows, I think any of the people who are publicly committed against him can't change their minds. As Hannah said, it's not a matter of here's this particular policy and I learned something new about the policy and therefore I changed my mind on it. The only thing I think that would give him cover is if John Lausch, U.S. attorney, had a statement saying, Michael Madigan is free and clear. we've looked at it. We decided he had no involvement in this at all. So he's totally innocent. Yeah, then they could maybe change their minds. But that is not going to happen.
Well, before I move off this topic again, I also wanted to mention, and Hannah, feel free to weigh in on this as well, but last Saturday the news came down that the former state senator Martin Sandoval had passed away. His name had come up as part of the federal investigation as well. He was apparently cooperating with the authorities. Anything you can add on that?
Right. So Marty Sandoval was, you know, kind of known as a larger than life figure in Springfield politics, powerful chair of this, the Senate Transportation Committee. And he had a big hand in the big infrastructure bill that was passed in 2019. Oh, the heady days of the governor's first legislative session, and lots was getting done, et cetera. But then several months later, it was September, and federal agents came to Springfield, came to Sandoval's Capitol office and raided it, and then also raided his Cicero district office and his home in Chicago. And since then, he had been under federal investigation. He stepped down from the Senate on January 1st, and then later that month, he took a plea deal and was cooperating with the feds. And we hadn't heard a ton from him this year, because obviously he had been living a quiet life trying to cooperate with the feds and lay low. Shortly before Thanksgiving, the feds filed something in federal court saying he's provided valuable cooperation in this probe. And again, we don't know exactly what he was saying. I'm not sure we'll ever know. But at that point, he was unfortunately already sick in the hospital with COVID, and it was a pretty bad case. And I don't know. It's just, it's shocking. It's sad. No matter what he might have done, no one deserves to die alone in the hospital.
Well, just a couple of moments left here. And speaking of COVID-19, everybody is, anticipating the vaccines coming. And it seems as though, Jerry, that Illinois could be seeing vaccine distribution before Christmas. So on a pretty fast track here.
Yeah, we don't know how quickly it will be available. Several months certainly is the timeline available for the general public. But at first, there's going to be nursing homes and hospital workers will be in the first in line for the vaccine. We honestly don't know how long it'll take to get all of them vaccinated. There's still some questions about which counties will be prioritized, considering some counties don't have hospitals that are in line to get them. So there's a lot to be followed up on by we reporters.
Yeah, Hannah, the phased in approach of this, I mean, it's kind of hard for people to understand, I think, exactly when they might be able to receive the vaccine. But right now, public health seems to be pretty sure that this is the way things are going to work, that this plan, or are they looking at some changes possibly?
I mean, for this first shipment of Pfizer vaccines, that seems pretty set in stone. I mean, things had been changing for a while, but right now everything seems to be on track for Illinois to receive 109,000 doses of Pfizer vaccines, and those will go to, healthcare workers. And although I guess I'm still a little bit unclear of when, because folks in long-term care facilities are also supposed to be prioritized, but 109,000 doses is just not very many. And that's the only one that we know for sure that we're going to get right away. Now, if the FDA also approves the Moderna vaccine, the governor said this week that we could get about 400,000, but he had a missive directly to reporters. He said, "I would not report that we are for sure going to get 400,000 of those Moderna doses." But yeah, I mean, things are up in the air, but I mean, at least we have this. Now, the 50 county list that Jerry mentioned, the governor's office received that or released that late last Friday evening. And those counties were prioritized or ranked by the death rates in those counties. But come to find out that some of those counties don't even have hospitals. So I guess some of those counties are voluntarily giving the doses that had been allocated to them to some of these larger, especially in central Illinois, with Sangamon, McLean, Champaign, and Peoria counties were not on the list, but those are locations in which there are these big regional hospitals that are, you know, doing the most work when it comes to treating the most critical COVID patients. And so it only makes sense that, you know, those vaccine doses actually get reallocated there. And the Department of Public Health director this week said that actually, yes, they are facilitating that. But it is, it makes you scratch your head, like, you didn't think of that? Like, did anyone approve this list?
It's time now for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which is the legislature's fiscal gurus, as they say, this week released its latest briefing on the state's pension systems and their financial condition. And it revealed that for fiscal year 2020, which ended last June 30th, the unfunded liability increased, and it's now $144 billion. The difference between the assets that the systems have based on their market value and the liability that they have to pay off pension benefits going forward, I guess, into infinity. And it's funded at 39%. And they also said that their estimate is that for fiscal year 2022, which is the budget that the legislature will be working on this spring, the increase in general funds to the pensions is going to be roughly $746 million. That would push it up to roughly $10.6 billion that we're going to be sending to the pension systems in 2022.
All right. And Jerry?
Yes, so the Electoral College is scheduled to meet Monday at 10 o'clock. The Secretary of State will preside, and it'll be in the Illinois House Chambers. So that's the Illinois electors. They will certify for President-elect Joe Biden.
And Hannah?
Well, it has been 38 days since Election Day, and there are 40 days until Inauguration Day. But the Trump camp is still holding on to hopes that they can get the election result overturned in the court. So an effort by the state of Texas filed this week. We had an amicus brief, which is an extra show of support brief filed by congressmen, and two Illinois congressmen, Darren LaHood and Mike Bast, are on that list. So they're on that list of folks who believe that Trump is the true winner and that, I guess, Joe Biden cheated.
That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. And get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.